going through the series on the soul. Today's the last time I'm going to talk about it. Next week, Don Dietrich, one of our state officials, is going to be here with us. He's going to talk about Jesus, the anchor of our soul. But then we'll head into our Christmas or our holiday series. But we've been going through the idea of the soul, talking about this thing called the soul. And the easy definition of it or explanation of it is found in Genesis chapter 2:7. And it says this. It says, "The Lord God made man from the dust of the earth, breathing into him the breath of life, the man became a living soul." So God created Adam out of the dust. Then there's this thing called the breath of life. He breathed it into Adam, and the combination of the two became a living soul. And boy, very demonstrated for me yesterday in interacting with Julie and her family is, you know, here's her breath, or her dust, which all of a sudden has an anomaly of this tumor that's pressing on her brain and, you know, giving her headaches as well as an inability to, you know, do certain things physically, drooping face and all those things. I mean, that's all just dust stuff. But then the fear and the anxiety and the worry, not only on her part, but other people in her life, you know, again, it just comes out in the breath of life. And because we're this connected being, you can't separate the two. They're directly connected one to another. The Hebrew concept of the soul was not so much that we possessed a soul, but that the soul, the word soul, describes everything about us. It describes the totality of who we are. Or another way of looking at it is human beings, it's not that human beings have a soul, but the human beings what? Are a soul. That you're a soul. And you're a soul. You're the combination of the dust and the breath of life. And the two are combined together. And what happens to your breath of life affects your dust. And what happens to your dust has a direct effect on your spirit, on your breath of life. Another way to look at it is that my soul is just that innermost, you know, part of who I am. And Dallas Willard says it this. He says, "The most important thing in your life is not what you do, it's who you become. That's what you will take into eternity." Just think about that line. That's what you'll take into eternity, is who you've become. You are an unceasing spiritual being with an eternal destiny in God's great universe. Your soul is not just something that lives on after your body dies. It's the most important thing about you. It is your life. And so it's that part of us that's our innermost being. I called the series "How's Your Soul?" And weeks ago I mentioned just the idea that when the founders of the Methodist Church founded the movement, what we call Methodism today, or the Methodist Church, when they founded it, they would actually interact with one another instead of just going, "Hey, how's it going?" or "How you doing?" They would actually ask one another in a probing kind of a way, "How's your soul?" Not "How's your body?" You know, you ask someone, "How you doing?" You go, "Oh man, my back's killing me." You know, okay, that's your dust, you know. No, they were asking the question, "How's it going in the very core of who you are? Right inside of you. How's it going?" G.K. Chesterton said this, wrote this years ago. He said, "While we often take ourselves too seriously, we can hardly take our souls seriously enough." Because it's so important. This who you are, the inner being of who you are, is so vastly important. So that question, "How's your soul?" You can't minimize how important that question is. How is it going with your soul? So we've talked about these questions. We've talked about you are a soul. We talked about the soul disintegration. You know, what I'm doing right now, what's it doing to my soul? We talked about when life disintegrates your soul, what's that doing to your soul? Another person's soul, like my wife, how I, you know, I'm a husband, it impacts my wife's soul, a parent, it impacts my kid's soul, grandparent impacts my grandkid's soul, so on. And last week we talked about, what are you telling yourselves? You know, we all talk to ourselves. We all talk to our souls. The Bible talks a lot about talking to your soul. And we all talk to our souls. But what are we telling our souls? What are the things we're saying to ourselves? And are they true? Are they not true? There's an ancient Latin manuscript that has these words. It says, "Wherefore play the game of life warily." I'll explain this to you in just a second. But "Wherefore play the game of life warily. For your opponent is full of subtlety. And take abundant thought over your moves, for the stake is your soul." So the idea is, when this thing called life, You need to live this life cautiously, because the enemy of life, the enemy of your soul, the idea being the enemy of your soul, very subtle. This works into people's lives in little tiny ways that become big ways. So the enemy is very subtle. And take abundant thought over the move you would make. What's the next thing you would do? You know, thinking of a chess game. What's the next thing you would do? Just think about what's the next thing you're going to do. Because the thing that is at stake is your soul. That's the thing that's at stake. Or Moses wrote it this way. He said, only be watchful and watch over your soul closely. Because this thing, that your innermost being, is the most important thing about you. So I want to talk about today about what I'm calling labels and frameworks. Okay? Labels and frameworks. What I want to do is I want to challenge you about some of the labels that you either have put on your own life or you've allowed other people to put on your life. And then some of the framework upon which, or you know, underneath the soul, your soul. Some framework ideas, and I'm going to give you some examples. But so I want to challenge you about, you know, why do we let certain things be labeled pretty? Why do we let certain things be labeled, you know, in ways of valuable and successful and smart and macho and wealthy and contentment? And, you know, why do we let other things label, you know, what's dumb and fat and worthless and unloved and unimportant? Why do we adopt the labels that we adopt? I mean, you have labels. You may not think about it this way, but I'm trying to give you some new terminology. You have some labels, some things that you tell yourself. You look in the mirror and you tell yourself. You try something and you tell yourself whatever it happens to you. Why do we accept the labels that we accept? Why have we accepted them? You know, last week I was at the Kelso's Life Group, and Rocky Deedy, Rocky and Wendy were Wycliffe Bible translators, he made these statements, and I go, oh, I got to take these notes down, because it was just so powerful. And what he talked about was that that how much we live in this tremendous time of confusion about identity. You know, he used the term an identity crisis, you know, where we're at as a culture. And I think we would all recognize this, you know, that there's just, who are we? Which group do we identify with? You know, when we're gonna self-identify. So people say, I'm gonna self-identify as, you know, whatever that happens to be. So I saw a person the other day in a news clip, a person who identifies, so they're confused about their identity. They identify as a dog. So they have someone lead them around who has a leash, has a harness, has a leash, and the person actually has little dog ears and walks around on all fours and identifies as a dog. I mean, it's just, and I see a bunch of you shaking your head like, that's crazy. Well, isn't that where we live today? People are trying to figure out who they are. I mean, what group is my friend? What group is my foe? Or when it comes to sexual identity, you know, the LGBTQI, you know, kind of thing, all the labels that go on. And the A at the end, you know, the A acronym at the end stands for asexual, which means I'm not going to be any of these groups. The problem is when you say I don't want to be part of any group, you've just joined a group. You guys know what I mean? You've just joined a group of people who don't want to be part of a group. So now you're part of the non-group group. But that, everybody's just trying to figure out politically and, you know, where, because they're asking the big questions about life. You know, the big questions about life is, who am I? Where do I belong? Where do I fit in connection to other people in life? And so, and because we're trying to figure out, who am I, where do I belong, and how do I fit with everybody else around, because people are asking that question, then oftentimes what they're doing is they grab a hold of labels that they shouldn't grab a hold of. I've been thinking about it over the last little while in this way. And, you know, I go to the grocery store, and prime shelf space in the grocery store, in the soup aisle, is given to what? To Campbell's soup. You know, it doesn't matter what grocery store you go to, but right there in the soup aisle, in the center, right at eye level for the average American, you know, maybe there's Progresso over here and there's something else, but right in the center is Campbell's soup. Now, why in the world does Campbell's soup get the premier label? You know, why is every other soup compared to Campbell's soup? Jimmy said in the first service, he said, because they make the most money for the store. But you know how they make the most money for the store? Because it's got a certain label, they can charge more. You know, this was like $1.69 for this can. This can was like $1.49. This can was like $1.29. So they give this the premier space, but because it's got a label that says Campbell's soup on it. But what's the interesting thing is you look at the ingredients in both of them, and you know what? They're almost identical. And sometimes they're cooked in the same factory. And yet what ends up happening is, for whatever reason, we go, you know, the Safeway signature says, I want to be a Campbell's soup. And you know, so you go to Safeway. I had to go to Winco and Safeway because I couldn't find, you know, the brands I wanted. But so this has the premier, you know, shelf space. And you know where this is Safeway's own brand. You know where it was? It was on the bottom shelf. It's not as good. Yeah. Oh, it's not. I don't know. I've never bought it. So I'm gonna send this home with you. Same thing. I go into Winco. And there's Winco, here's the Campbell's soup in the center, and Winco's down on the bottom. Okay? So, but again, they're just labels. Matter of fact, you know what I could have done, and I thought about doing this, was just cut the labels and put the labels on opposite cans. Because it's just a label put on a can. But we allow our people to put labels on us. We allow society to put labels. Let me illustrate it this way. And I'm not picking on doctors. We have doctors in our church. I'm not picking on doctors, and I'm not picking on mechanics. We have mechanics in our church. But let me just use a little illustration. As a culture, we say doctors are the Campbell soup of the world. They're the Campbell soup of the world. For goodness sake, they're a doctor. The problem is there are Campbell soup doctors that could not get to work if they didn't have a Winco mechanic who could fix their car. Am I saying mechanics are Winco? No. I'm saying, why do we let doctors be Campbell's soup when that doctor could not even get to work? He could not get to work if he didn't have someone else who could repair his BMW. And you know what? This guy can repair his BMW, the doctor's BMW in his sleep. And the doctors depended upon him to get there. I told this in the first service, and Matt, who's back in the sound room, Matt came up to me afterwards, and he said when he was in school, in high school, he had shoulder injury, and so they had shoulder surgery, and then he was going to have a second shoulder surgery. And the surgeon came in, and he had his hand all bandaged up. That's not a good sign when your surgeon has his hand all bandaged up. He said, you know, I'm going to get, you know, one of my partners to do this, and he's very qualified. And he said, so, and what this doctor did was he stuck his hand under a lawnmower. Every landscaper knows you don't stick your hand. How many of you know you don't stick your hand under a lawnmower? Oh, gosh. I mean, we're just Winco people. And we know you don't stick your hand under a lawnmower. Do you get the point? I mean, why do we give certain people labels and we let that become the determining factor? You know, in regards, so we, you know, we let these labels determine, well, they're the sexy ones. They're the most valuable ones. You know, they're the ones that are going to make all the money. They're the ones that, you know, everybody cheers, everybody wants to see. Why do we do that? And I know people who look at their lives and they go, gosh, Matt, I'm just not a Campbell's soup person. I'm not. You know, I don't even know if I'm a Safeway signature or Winco, whichever one you want to put. But, you know, I don't even know that I'm this. And the funny thing about them is, they have looked at whatever the qualifiers are and go, I'm not a Campbell's soup person. And yet, other people would look at their lives and go, you know what? I wish I had the talents they had. I wish I had the personality they had. I wish I had the organization skills they had. I wish I had the way to counsel the way they do. I wish I had the way to build friendships the way they do. And there's people who look at them and go, gosh, I want to be them. Because they're saying they're the Campbell soup, or they want to be like them. But this person spends their whole life feeling in fear, feeling second class, because in whatever it is that we label ourselves with, we go, I don't match up. Everybody understand what I'm talking about? And that's what we do. And the problem is we are allowing other people and we're allowing culture to identify, to dictate our identity. And that determines the health of our soul. You know, there's a story in the Old Testament about David, and I'll use the line, and then if you're not familiar with it, I'll tell you just a little bit of the story. But it's David and David and Goliath. Okay, David and Goliath. And, you know, so the children of Israel were in battle against another group of people, and there was a giant by the name of Goliath, great big huge guy, and he'd come out and he'd go, you know, send somebody out to fight against me, and Israel, the Jewish people would run, and, you know, they would, you know, nobody wanted to fight. And finally, David, who's this young teenage guy, he goes out to find out how his brothers are doing, and he sees this, the Philistine army, and he sees Goliath and, you know, making this taunt, and go, come out and fight, and they all run. And David goes, well, what's the problem? Let's just go fight him. Let's just go take care of him. And he goes into Saul, who's the king. Again, David's a teenager. Goes into Saul, who's a king. And Saul finally convinces Saul to let him fight. And then Saul gives him his armor. And if you remember the story, Saul gives him his armor. And David puts on the armor and he says what? He says, I can't go out in this. This isn't my stuff. He said, it doesn't fit. What the portrayal is that David was saying, you know what, that's not my identity. I can't fight like that. Because what we do is we allow other people to determine and to define who we are. We let someone who in our life at some point told us we were a loser to determine that, okay, I'm going to be a loser. You're not very smart. You can't do math. Whatever it happens to be. I mean, we just let people put these labels on us, and then we live our lives following after the labels. See, a healthy soul comes from the center of our being, where our identity is defined by God, not by others. That's where a healthy soul comes from. The Apostle Paul traveled after he became a follower of Jesus. You know, he was involved in arresting Christians and, you know, and seeing Stephen, the first martyr, stoned and all that stuff. Then he traveled around the Roman Empire for the rest of his life, the next 30 years until he was executed. Traveled around the Roman Empire starting churches. And he'd go into a community, he would tell them about the life, death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus. People would start following after Jesus, and this church would get started. And then Paul would leave and he would go to another place. And oftentimes when he went to another place, some other people would come in behind him and they would try and kind of usurp or override some of the work Paul did. So in Corinth, Paul went into Corinth. He started this church in Corinth. Then he left. And then after he left Corinth, there's this group of people who came into Corinth, the city of Corinth in the Roman Empire, who Paul called super apostles. It's a sarcastic term. But he called them super apostles. And so they came in after him. And here's what he says. Here's what Paul says. He says, I hope you will put up with a little more of my foolishness. Please bear with me, for I am jealous for you with the jealousy of God himself. I promised you as a pure bride to one husband, Christ. But I fear that somehow your pure devotion and your pure and undivided devotion to your husband, Christ, will be corrupted, just as Eve was deceived by the cunning ways of the serpent. Go ahead and go to the next slide. You happily put up with whatever anyone tells you, even if they preach a different Jesus than the one we preach, or a different kind of spirit than the one you received, or a different kind of gospel than the one you believed. But I don't consider myself inferior in any way to those super apostles who teach such things. So, Paul goes into Corinth, starts a church, and then after he's, you know, got the church started, he leaves, and in comes these people who start telling everybody, I'm a Campbell's soup apostle. Okay? Paul, he was just a Safeway signature apostle. But I'm a Campbell's soup apostle, is what I am. And for whatever reason, the people in Corinth believed that these guys were super apostles. And Paul then, he goes on and he starts listing his qualifications. Paul says, you know what? I'm not a Campbell's soup apostle. I'm more like a Safeway signature apostle because, see, I can't talk very well. I'm not a great communicator. And I also don't take money from you. I haven't made myself a burden to you. So I know I'm not like the super apostles. He's just, it's total sarcasm here on Paul's part. I'm not going to be like those super apostles, because those super apostles, man, they have such incredible wisdom and their achievements and they you know what else they do? I've never done this because I'm not a Campbell soup apostle, but those guys, you know what they do? They manipulate you. They take advantage of you. They come in and see you as an opportunity for their personal advancement. But I'm not like the Campbell soup apostle, okay? Because I'm not going to let anybody identify me as something less because I'm not a Campbell soup. So here's how Paul goes on. He says, you put up with it when someone enslaves you or takes everything from you, everything you have, or takes advantage of you or takes control of everything and slaps you in the face. I am ashamed to say that we've been too weak to do that. But whatever they dare to boast about, I am going talking like a fool again. I dare to boast about it too. And then he goes on. He spends the next seven verses talking about he talks about all the times he suffered, how many times he was beaten, how many times he was arrested, how many times he was in danger, shipwreck, all those kinds of things. He talks about all those things. And then he says this, and if I must boast, I would rather boast about the things that show how weak I am. He says, I'd rather boast about being a Safeway signature apostle than I would about being a Campbell soup apostle. You know what he's saying? I'm not going to let anybody label me because they're somehow, this is who they are. Somehow, you know, they take advantage of people and they come in boasting and they got all this wisdom and all this stuff and they put me down. I'm, you know what? They can boast about all that if they want. I don't care about being a Campbell soup, because you know what? Being a Campbell soup apostle is not important to me. I'm going to be who God wants me to be. I'm going to be who God made me to be. Here's what Henry Nouwen says. We are not who we know ourselves to be, but who we are known to be by God. And that's what Paul was saying. He goes, you know, in his thing, he goes, you know what? It's not even important what other people say about me. You know what's important about? Is what God says about me. And my identity is going to be found in what God says about me. Last week I handed out those, you know, that were out in the foyer, all the I am statements, the statements about who I am in Jesus. But we spend our lives letting society label us. We do. And then we feel insecure. Because I'm not pretty, or I'm not smart, or I'm not, talented, or whatever it happens to be. And we let ourselves be labeled by that, and because of that, we feel insecure, and because we're insecure, our soul's not what it should be, and because our soul's not what it should be, you know what we do? We never accomplish what God wants us to accomplish. Soren Kierkegaard prayed this prayer, and I think it's just a fabulous prayer we ought to all pray. And he says, and now, Lord, with your help, I shall become myself. And now with your help, Lord, I'm going to become me. I'm going to become me. Because when you're you and I'm me, that's the healthiest spot for our soul to be. It's not healthy for me to try and take my soul and to make it like Greg's. It's not healthy. Or for me to take my soul and somehow try and be Brian. It's not healthy. Or Mike. It's not healthy. Or Link. It's not healthy. Or Adam or Jack. It's not healthy. What's healthy for me and my soul is to be who God made me to be. Is everybody with me? Okay. Let me walk you to another statement, another idea. And that is the idea of framework. Okay. Your soul and my soul can only be as healthy as the framework underneath which our soul gets built and gets formed. So think about it in this way. And there's a picture of a house frame here. You know, somebody framing a house. We see them all over Whidbey Island. But, you know, just a frame. Well, you want to live in a house that's framed like that house, not a house that let's just grab some siding and let's just nail the siding together and let's just somehow lean the roof up over it and, you know, hopefully it'll stand through all the, you don't want to live in a house like that. You want to live in a house that has good framework underneath it. And all of us have certain things that make up our framework It's our theology. It's what we think about God and what we think about life and what we think about, you know, how life works. The theology underneath it. We have this framework upon which our theology, which is built out of theology, which our soul hangs on. So some of those things would go like this. Hopefully I can help you understand this. Here's how some of those things go. Like one of the theology things that people grab a hold of is, you know what, I should be happy. Okay? Then all of a sudden, because that's one of the frameworks that somehow I should be happy, that framework, that begins to dictate all kinds of other things in their life, that I should be happy. Or you know what, I shouldn't have to go through these hard times. Or God must be against me. I talk to people all the time, you know, and one of their framework ideas is that this is happening in my life right now because God's against me. God's not happy with me. For whatever reason that is, and they can pull things from, you know, from this time period or that time period or this they did or that they did, whatever it happens to be, and they go, God just must not be happy with me right now because this is what's happening in my life. And it's one of those frameworks they have. Or, I must have done something wrong, or man, they must be doing something really right because look at what's happening in their life. Jesus, when he was traveling around the countryside, came upon this blind man, and a very telling story. So Jesus comes upon this blind man, and the disciples, not the religious leaders, not the Pharisees, Sadducees, not the teachers of the law, the religious leaders saw this blind man, and they asked Jesus the question. Here's how it goes. It says, as Jesus went along, he saw a man blind from birth, and his disciples asked him, Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind? Again, this is not the religious leaders that are asking Jesus. This is not, as their culture would be, this is not the Campbell's Soup people that are asking the question. This is not the Safeway Signature people that are asking. This is the unschooled fishermen who are asking the question as their society looked at it. And they said, they saw this man born blind, and they go, okay, whose fault is this? Is this the parents' fault or is this the kid's fault? Because see, their framework said that if someone was suffering, if someone was poor, if someone was in the living on the margins of life, if someone was homeless, if someone was, you know, without a job, if someone was whatever happens to be, all, you know, you put whatever qualifiers you want in there. If someone was, you know what? They're doing it because somebody's to blame. Somebody's at fault here. That was their framework. That was their idea. That if you were in that situation, their theology had been built around this idea that, you know, if you're poor, you must have done something wrong. And this is not just Jesus' time. You go back 2,000 years plus prior to Jesus to the life of Job. If you remember the story of Job, you know, Job's this guy, he's very, very wealthy, he's got a family, he's got land, he's the wealthiest man in his, you know, neck of the woods, and the enemy comes and says, you know what, Job just serves you because you give him all the stuff, we'll take all the stuff away, he'll still serve me, takes all the stuff away, Job still serves him. He said, well, you're only serving God because your family, and he goes, well, take away my family, you know, and the funny part about the story, the ironic part of the story, the only one he's left with is what? His wife. And what does his wife say? Why don't you just curse God and die? You know, I mean, some supportive wife in the middle of the whole trauma that was going on. But his three advisors come along and they go, surely, Job, you've done something what? Wrong. Surely you said something. Surely you did something. Again, this is... This is not theology that just was popped up in Jesus' time. This is what for a couple thousand years the Jewish people had believed. That if something wasn't right, God must be against me. This is my fault. There's a pastor down in Southern California named Larry Osborne who has written this great book. And it's called 10 Dumb Things That Smart Christians Believe. 10 Dumb Things That Smart Christians Believe. Like, here's one of them. That faith can fix anything. That faith, I mean, you've heard it. If you've been around someone who's, you know, having family struggles, whatever it happens to be, or their health struggles or whatever, and someone will inevitably tell them, you know what, you just got to believe more. You don't have enough faith. You just got to apply faith. You got to have faith. If you have faith, you know, it's not going to happen. As if faith will solve everything. Or how about forgiveness means forgetting? Or how about a godly home means you're going to have godly children? Okay? I mean, if you think about that, just that one alone, if you think about that, was there a more godly parent than who? Than God. I mean, God is the godly one of God. You know, he's like the God behind godly is God. Does everybody know what I'm talking about? I mean, that's him, okay? And he put his kids not just, you know, in some neighborhood somewhere. His kids lived where? In what? In paradise. So here's like the godliest of all godly, the origin of all godly parenting, who has his kids in paradise. And what do the kids say? No thanks. I want to do it my own way. I'm going to go in my own direction. See again, the structure, if you're living under the structure that if I just have a godly house, then all of my kids will be godly, bad theology, bad structure. Okay? And it's going to do damage to your soul. Or how about a valley means I took a wrong turn? A valley doesn't mean necessarily you took a wrong turn. A valley just means you're in a valley. That's all it means. Now, it could mean you took a wrong turn, and therefore you're in a valley, but you get out of it. Or how about Christians shouldn't judge? Christians shouldn't judge. You hear people say this all the time, Christians shouldn't judge. That's stupid. Of course Christians judge. Now, if we're talking about judging in the sense that you exclude people and you make people enemies, all that stuff, but just to make this blanket statement, Christians shouldn't judge, like, let's say Adam wants to borrow some money from me, okay? I have to make a judgment on whether I'm going to loan Adam money or not, because to not make, Christians shouldn't judge. Here, go ahead, you can have it, Adam. That's total stupidity. Of course I'm going to make a judgment as to whether Adam should be loaned money or not. Again, it's just bad structure, but bad structure leads us to make bad decisions, and bad decisions and bad structure does damage to our soul. Let me just walk you through a framework that's become that I tore down the framework of this area in my life, and over the last few years have rebuilt the framework to be what I think God wants me to have this framework to be. Okay, and it has to do with success. See, in the world we live in right here, in America, we determine success in a lot of ways. We determine them this way. I am, my identity, and whether I'm successful or not, I am with this idea, I am what I do. Because I'm a doctor. So I'm a doctor, I'm a Campbell's soup guy. Okay, well, I'm a teacher, whatever. You just figure out your identity becomes based upon, and your picture of success becomes based upon, you know, what I do. Or how about what I have? What I have. You know, in the sense that my significance comes from the fact that I have, you know, a college degree, I have a doctorate, I drive a big car, I have a big fancy house, whatever it happens to be. Which, what if you don't have any of those things? Does that mean all of a sudden now you're not successful? Not at all. Doesn't mean any of those things. Or how about I am, and I'm as successful if based upon what other people think of me. What other people think of you is not a determiner of what success looks like. It's not a determiner. You know, James Emery White back in North Carolina has done some writing recently about research that's been done by a travel company called, what's the travel company called? It's called First Choice. And this travel company has surveyed a bunch of young people across the country, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of young people, to find out what do you want to be in life? You know, what do you want to be? Because when I grew up, you know, which I know it was a long time ago, but when I grew up, you know, you ask someone, hey, what do you want to be when you grew up? And they would say, I want to be a policeman or a fireman, or I want to be a doctor, I want to be a soldier, I want to be, you know, a nurse, I want whatever it happens to be, all those kinds of things. 75% of these students that have been surveyed said, you know what, when I grow up, I want to have a career in online videos. Now, some of the older folks in the church, you're like, I have no idea what you're talking about. Just bear with me for a minute, okay? I want to make my living on online videoing. A third of those 75% that responded that way said, you know what? I want to make my living being a YouTuber. Okay. Now YouTube, probably everybody knows what YouTube is, but YouTube has people make their whole living on YouTube. They do something and they get subscribers, like they give fashion advice or they give makeup advice or they repair cars or they, repair computers or they do music or whatever it happens to be. I mean, it's unbelievable all the things that people do. And so they do this and then they get subscribers. And by getting subscribers, if you got 1,000 subscribers, you got 10,000 subscribers, you got 1 million subscribers, you got 3.5 million subscribers, you got 6 million subscribers, whatever it happens to be. And then based on how many people watch your videos, then companies determine that they will advertise on your YouTube channel. And so they'll advertise. And every time someone goes to that video, there's that little, if you've been on YouTube, even those of you that don't really understand all that I'm talking about right now, but you've been on YouTube before, and that little video comes up and says you can just skip this ad in 4 seconds. The reason you can skip that ad in 4 seconds, not that you skip the ad, but the reason that ad is there is because someone's paying that guy to be, that's a YouTuber. So 1/3 of the 75% who said, what I want to do in life is I want to be an online video guy or person. 25% of them, I want to be a YouTuber. Or 30%, a third of them said, I want to be a YouTuber. The rest of them said, I want to be a vlogger. Okay? So a vlogger is just someone who makes same kind of a thing. They may not do it on YouTube, but they make a video. And they video instructions, video advice, video counsel, video whatever it happens to be. They're going to do that. And that's what they want to be. So success in their minds is being online and people seeing it and people subscribing to it. Well, for me, let me just tell you what success looks like. You can label, you have to build your structure. But here's what I think success looks like. And again, I've tore down what I thought it was, and this is now the structure. Is I am a tiny little part in a 2,000 year plus going on puzzle that God's doing. You know when you go up in the ferry and you go up there and there's a table and there's a puzzle there and somebody sits down and you put a couple pieces in the puzzle and then you get up and you leave and then somebody else sits down behind you and they put a couple pieces in, kind of thing, and maybe you come back and the puzzle's there or the puzzle's gone, whatever that happens to be. That I'm part of a 2,000 year plus puzzle that God's putting together that started with the disciples clear back 2,000 years ago. And my task is to put the puzzle pieces where the puzzle pieces should be in the place God's placed me. And that means right now Whidbey Island. God's placed me here. My job is not to look back and or look forward. My job is what does God want me to do right here, right now, with what I have? What is He wanting me to do to put my pieces together? And when it's all said and done, if I've been faithful to put the pieces as, pastoring in the church, pastoring in the community, if I've done my task of being faithful to put the puzzle pieces where God wanted the puzzle pieces to be, and then God takes me out of here, either I die or I move or whatever it happens to be, I won't even know what the end of the puzzle looks like. I mean, isn't this how it works? You come and sit down at that puzzle, and there's part of it that's already put together, and you put a few pieces in, and then you get up and leave, but you have no idea who did any of that other stuff. Well, that's life. Somebody came before me. Somebody will come after me. Again, I'm just telling you as a pastor, you in your industry, in your world, in your mind, you have to figure out success. But for me, success is, am I being faithful to do what God has placed before me to do? And if I'm being faithful to do that, then that is what success looks like. Because when Paul said this, he said, whatever you eat or drink, or, and then he uses this huge qualifier, whatever you do, you do it to the glory of God. Remember when you were in school and you're 7 years old and you sit down at school, you're in school and teacher hands out all the, the paper, and then you start working on the paper, and she says to you, the teacher says to you, now keep your eyes on what? Your own paper. Did nobody ever say that? Okay, keep your eyes on your own paper. You know why they were saying that? Not because they didn't want you to cheat, but because, although they didn't want you to cheat, but the reason they didn't want you to cheat is because if you got your eyes on their paper and you're filling out your paper while you're looking at their paper, and she takes your paper and tries to figure out whether you're learning or not, you know what she's figuring out? That guy's learning or not learning. He's not figuring out what you're learning or not learning. It's like God says this to each one of us. He says, write your name on top of your paper and keep your eyes on your own paper, because it doesn't matter what the person next to you is doing. You do what I've laid before you to do. Isn't that how God does it? You just do, because you are a unique individual with a unique family, with a unique background, with a unique future, with a unique soul. And God has something for you to do, and he's just asking you, don't look at other people's papers, because what other people are doing on their paper doesn't matter, because I don't care. I want to know, are you doing what I've laid before you to do? So just take your paper out, put your name on top of it, and you do what I've laid before you to do. And that, again, here's how it goes for a pastor in the world we're living in today. I mean, every time you turn on the TV or you turn on the radio or you whatever it happens to be, there are superstar pastors you guys know what I'm talking about. Everybody wants to hear them and see them and listen to them and all that stuff. You know what? So I could spend my whole life going crazy because looking on everybody else's paper. But God says, Matt, stop looking on everybody else's paper. You got a paper in front of you with your name on it. You do, and you put the puzzle pieces together the way I want you to be. So it's not my job to go, well, Brett down at Calvary Chapel, and I love the pastors on South Louis, so I'm not picking on any pastor to love. But my job is not to look on Brett's paper and figure out what Brett's doing. My job is not to look on, Andy's up at Christian Life Center, Andy's paper and figure out what Andy's doing, or Jim, or figure out what he's doing, or Jim Lindis to figure out what he's doing. I got my own paper. And I'm called to be faithful to the paper in front of me. Is everybody? And for me, that's the framework. That's the framework of success. It's one of the reasons I love endurance sports. Marathoning and cycling and stuff. One of the reasons I love them is because it's a competition, at least at my level. Again, I'm not a Campbell Soup marathoner, I'm a Winco marathoner. But you know what? It's not a competition against anybody else. It's a competition against my capabilities and how hard I've trained or how hard I haven't trained and whether I've gotten hurt or not. That's all it is. So it's just a total, it's a competition against me. It's one of the reasons I love it, because that's the only competition there is in life, is what is God asking me to do, and am I being faithful to do what God has asked me to do? I don't have your kids. I have my kids. Right? I don't. I have my kids. I don't have your talents. I have my talents. When we adopted Kelly and Kyle from Cambodia and brought them home, started raising them, and if you know our boys, man, music just pours out of every cell in their body. It just oozes out of them. It comes so naturally, which was so unique for us, because our other three kids, my oldest son, Nathan, he has no music oozing out of any pore in his body. he's learned to play the guitar, works so hard at it, he's trying to learn how to sing, he works so hard at it, And, Kelly and Kyle have been, it's just oozed out of him, and Nathan's been given this itty titty little tiny bit of talent. But Nathan's not responsible to look on Kelly and Kyle's paper and go, gosh, I'm not like, he's responsible for what God's given him and to do what God's given him to do. Does that make sense? Okay, well, let me give you one more, and then we'll pray. Because there is only one line, according to the parable of the talents, there's only one line that will be important the day you stand before Jesus. Is well done, what? Good and faithful servant. Oh, Matt, you became a Campbell Soup pastor. Congratulations. No, you know what he's going to say? You were faithful. You were faithful to do what I put you in a place to do. You were faithful to do it. So one more framework. How about the sovereignty of God? Man, Christians have such bad theology when it comes to the sovereignty of God. The idea of the sovereignty of God is that God answers to no one. God answers to no one. What that means is, you may not like what God does, tough luck. Because he doesn't answer to anyone. And not only that, but everyone will answer to God. Well, I don't believe in God. Well, you will one day when you're answering to him. Okay, because you're going to answer to, because everybody, he answers to no one, and everyone will answer to him. And he's over all, he's above all, he does things differently than human beings do things, and he, you know, he's beyond us, he's beyond time and space. Here's how David said it. Here's how David said it. He's not being flippant, but here's how David said it. The Lord does what he pleases in heaven and on earth and in the seas and the deep oceans. It's like, you know what? God does what God wants to do. He's God. We're not. Or David, or Paul wrote it this way in the book of Acts. He said, the God who made the world and everything in it, being Lord of heaven and earth, does not live in temples made by hands, nor is he served by human hands as though he needed anything, since he himself gives all mankind life and breath and everything. He made made from one man every nation of mankind to live on the earth, all the face of the earth, having determined allotted periods and boundaries for their dwelling place, that they should seek God and perhaps feel their way toward him and find him. Yet he is actually not far from each one of us, for in him we live and we move and we have our being. He's over all. He's just above all. Or Paul wrote it in Colossians to the church in Colossae. He said this. He said, by him all things were created in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or rulers or authorities. All things were created through him and for him, and he is before all things, and in him all things hold together. I mean, he's like over everything. And one of the things that I just keep telling people over and over again, I told Kayla's mom last night in the hospital, I looked her right in the eye, she's laying there with a brain tumor knowing she's going to have surgery coming up, and I said, Julie, this did not take God by surprise. God doesn't chew his fingernails. You know what I mean? You know, like didn't see that coming. Nothing takes God by surprise. He doesn't chew his fingernails. He has fingernails. He has them all, okay, because he doesn't chew them. None of it takes him by surprise. Cancer diagnosis doesn't take God by surprise. Family breakup doesn't take God by surprise. An accident doesn't take God by surprise. None of it takes God by surprise. Because he's over all. He's outside of all of it. And he's beyond time and beyond all those things. You know, and what this does, that believing in the sovereignty of God, what this does is this brings this reassurance and this hope, kind of this conviction using our modern terms, that God could say to you, you know what, I got this. I got this. I got it. You know, Greg and Gloria, you guys over the last few years gone through terrible struggle, business. I don't know, terrible is not the right word. A tough valley of business. But one of the assurances I know you guys have continually had is God's got this. If you don't like it, it doesn't look great, but God's got this. God's got this. That's the conviction that sovereignty brings. God's got this. God's got this. Because here's your options. Here's your options. If you don't have a structure that your soul is built upon, that God's got, that God is sovereign over all, you'll get mad at people. You'll get mad at God. You'll get mad at life, or you'll get mad at all of them, or any combination thereof. Now, I think God is so big and so amazing that he has no problem with me being mad at him. And there's been times I'm mad at God. And I've told him, I said, God, this is not right. This should not be this way. You know, when our youngest grandson was born, not our youngest, I guess now, but when Ezra was born, Nathan and Kelsey's little boy, I remember saying, God, it is not right that Kelsey is in the hospital right now giving birth to Ezra, and her mom is not here. Her best friend is not here. So there's times where I just tell God, God, this isn't right. It should not be this way. But you know what? He's God. And I don't like it, and I tell God I don't like it, but I'm still, my structure says, he's God. He's over all. He doesn't have to answer to me. Or, you know what you do? If you don't have that structure, you know what you try to start doing? Is you try to control everything and everyone in your life. And I just ask the question, how's that going for you? Because if he's sovereign, you know, like, I don't like what God's doing. So you're just trying to control everything and control, or you spend your life worrying. And I've told you before, I'm a self-confessed worrier. But part of my you know, ridding worry out of my life is coming to the conclusion, none of this takes God by surprise. God's above this. God's got this. So I don't have to worry about it. I don't have to worry about it. So let me ask you a couple questions and we'll pray. Going back to the labels thing, what labels have you allowed people to put on your life? You know, what labels, or what labels have you put on your life? You know, you tell yourself, you go, you know, you start telling yourself these things that are labels, and you pretty soon you start believing these labels. What are some of those labels? Or what's some structure that needs changed? Because your soul's not very healthy because you got bad structure. What's some of that structure, some of that framework that needs to change? Lord, you know each one of us in this room. You know our past, you know our present, you know our future. You know every person we've ever talked to, you know every person we'll ever talk to. You know every circumstance that have happened in our lives, you know every circumstance that's going to happen in our lives. You know how we react to things. You know the things that we've allowed people to label us and we've labeled ourselves. And you know the areas where our framework, our theology, our view of you and our view of life and our view of how you work in the world needs changed. And so, Lord, we pray this week, be at work in our lives. Mold us, shape us, teach us, instruct us, rearrange us. Do what you're wanting to do, God, so that we can have souls and we can be the souls you desire for us to be. So Lord, pinpoint. I just pray for men in the room, you'd pinpoint labels. For women, you'd pinpoint labels. For young men and young women, you'd pinpoint labels. You'd pinpoint structures, you know, foundational structures and framework that needs to be changed and needs to be rearranged. So again, so that we could have healthy souls and be living the way you want us to live. So we commit ourselves to you in Jesus' name. Say amen.